This is Eleanor Thwent continuing the interview with Simon Strauss in Lenox, Massachusetts on August 25th, 1994. You were saying that for many years you chaired the Committee of the American Mining Congress on Minerals Availability.
That's correct. And the stockpile issue was in its board. I am no longer a member of that committee. The organization has kindly given me the title of Chairman Emeritus. And on occasion, I do meet with a committee, but the occasions are not many, and I have not testified on the issue in, I would say, about 10 years. So I'm on the sidelines on that issue today, but it's hardly
a moot issue, though.
Yes, correct. I was very active. I suppose I made 40 or 50 appearances before congressional committees on the stockpile issue during the years that I was at ASARCO. And
that's why a tape recorder doesn't scare you now.
That is correct. I also spoke for the Mining Congress on some other issues like trade issues. And I think I said earlier on the silver coinage issue, I represented the silver producers and later the Mining Congress in regard to that matter. So I tried to be helpful to the Mining Congress, prepared some of their pamphlets. And that took a good deal of time.
Are there other nations that stockpile, other than, we know the Soviet Union did, but do the nations of Europe, for example?
They've had debates. The French had modest, very modest stockpiles. The British used to talk about it, but never did. They don't have the financial resources to do it. The Japanese have had some stockpiles, but while they cover most of the essential materials, they tend to be for 3 months or 6 months. And I think the Japanese don't regard them as necessary or defense-related. I think they're there to guard against interruptions in supply if there were shipping strikes or something of that sort. So those are the principal ones. I think Sweden had some stockpiles for a while, and the Swiss. But the Swiss, of course, are very close-mouthed about what they do and what they don't do. But my impression is that they have, since they're totally import-dependent, there's virtually no mineral production of significance in Switzerland. So perhaps a logical matter to move on to after this discussion of stockpiles is my connection with governmental organizations of various kinds. Perhaps my most enduring and interesting assignment was as a member of the advisory committee to the U.S. delegation to the International Lead Zinc Study Group. I've earlier referred to the U.S. Import quotas on lead and zinc that caused a good deal of fuss. Sometime in the 60s, the principal producing countries concerned with lead and zinc, and many of the principal consuming countries, agreed that it would be useful to have an international group under the wing of the United Nations to to discuss the problems of lead and zinc. The pressure for this came primarily from the four big lead zinc exporting countries, Canada, Peru, Mexico, and Australia. But the United States indicated was willing to join. The United Kingdom, which is primarily a consuming country, France, Western Germany, Japan, all agreed. And so several meetings were held in New York at the UN to discuss what, if anything, could be done to cope with the problems of surpluses and deficits or shortages of these two metals. And there was a general consensus on one problem, and that was that the statistics weren't as good as they might be. And actually, this group, after it was formally chartered by the UN as an international study group, set up a monthly statistical bulletin, and all the member countries were asked to contribute their official statistics. This is fine, except that some of the countries are a little more careful in compiling their statistics than some of the others. But once a year, the group meets, usually in Geneva, but it has also met in such places as Munich, Mexico City, Tokyo, Malaga in Spain, and there may be others that I don't recall. Once a year, there is a meeting. The official delegates to the study group are always government employees. In the case of the United States, it is usually someone from the State Department with the advice of somebody from Interior and somebody from Commerce, but also with the advice of a group of industry people. There was some concern about ASARCO's being represented in the group, because ASARCO was not only a lead and zinc producer in the United States, but it had the Buchan's lead zinc mine in Canada, it had its operations in Mexico, which were subsequently Mexicanized, and it had its large interest in Mount Isa in Australia. And I think some people said, well, you know, if ASARCO is here, they're going to be conferring with the Mexicans and Peruvians and Canadians and Australians, and maybe things that we want kept confidential aren't going to be quite so confidential. It was a tricky issue. But finally, the State Department indicated they did want somebody from ASARCO to go, and for the first 10 or 15 years, I was the person. There were also representatives from St. Joe, American Zinc, National Zinc, American Metal, and other companies. The meetings were very interesting.
Sure.
Because you had an opportunity to talk to everybody from around the world during a brief week in Geneva or wherever it might be. And I think some useful work was done, but I can't say that it has really revolutionized the lead and zinc business.
A lot of fun for the delegates.
It was a certain amount of
a lot of fun,
enjoyment.
But interesting.
Yeah, and speeches were made. The Peruvian delegate for years was the Peruvian ambassador in the United States, Fernando Berkemeyer. That's B-E-R-C-K-E-M-E-Y-E-R. His wife was a lady from San Francisco, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And Fernando was a very good friend of mine. And he didn't really have much of a feel for the Lansing statistics, so he used to lean fairly heavily on me to explain to him what was being said and why. In fact, if truth be told, he spent as much time reading the daily racing form, because he was a great follower of race, as he did listening to the proceedings. But when he spoke, it was as a result of instructions that he got from Lima. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of very distinguished people who were involved in the organization. The U.S. delegate, the first delegate, was a chap named Nichols. When he was replaced in the commodities end at the State Department, the next man was, I think, Hall and Branson, B-R-A-N-S-O-N, if I remember correctly. I recall as being the leader at our meeting in Mexico City. And then eventually, the official delegate was Charles Carlyle. Charles Carlyle was a particularly effective spokesman. Eventually, he left government service, worked first as the head of the domestic U.S. Lead Zinc Producers Committee, mm-hmm. and later became the vice president of St. Joe Lead. When St. Joe Lead was acquired by Fluor, he left to return first to government service. He worked in the ITO, the trade, that isn't the correct initials, but the Office of International Trade, being given the rank of ambassador. And most recently, until last year, in fact, he was the number two man, the deputy secretary general of the conference of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs.
Yeah.
So his judgment and his abilities were widely recognized, not just in the metals business, but in the broad international trade business. I think he's now a consultant on trade matters with offices in New York. Charles didn't have much of a background when he started on this in metal production, and he depended on his industry advisors to a great extent. It was talk for many years about forming a similar study group on copper. You've got a muscle pull or something?
A little bit. I'm okay.
Yeah. Forming a similar group on copper. It started while I was still at ASARCO. And it's finally materialized about 2 years ago.
Really?
In this case, for reasons which I don't know, the official U.S. delegate is not from the State Department, but from the Commerce Department, a gentleman by the name of Bob Riley, R-E-I-L-L-Y. And they're just beginning to talk about improving statistics and so forth. It'll probably be a useful way of exchanging information about copper developments, but like lead zinc, I think the net effect is not going to be substantial in changing the nature of the trade.
Mm-hmm.
So I have played no role at all on this copper study group. I was asked during the Carter administration to serve on a committee, and we met for 2 years. give you the name of it because it was one of these fancy government.
They all begin to sound alike.
They all begin to sound alike. The purpose of this was to really bring up to date the kind of considerations that the Paley Commission had had in 1950, and was there a big problem, wasn't there a big problem. We issued a report, which is, as usual, gathering dust somewhere in there. But these things all took a lot of time and effort, and could not be ignored. Because if people who are knowledgeable will not participate, then the results of some of these studies could really be quite damaging, I think.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
For quite a few years, I was asked by the War College in Washington to give an annual lecture on the non-ferrous metals industry to the people at the War College, who are people of the rank of majors or colonels or lieutenant commanders and commanders in the case of the Navy. It was an assignment I really enjoyed because the problems were new to most of the colonels, but they asked very good questions.
And that's, of course, where it becomes most acute.
That's right, because they have some weird ideas about metals. This is going back to the days of World War II. I never will forget the day that the fellow in charge of producing galvanized pipe at Bethlehem Steel told me that he'd had a hurry-up call from a colonel who was in charge of construction of a barracks somewhere, and Bethlehem was a little late in making delivery of the pipe to this barracks site, and the colonel said, "What's holding it up?" And the Bethlehem chap said, "Well, the pipe had been produced, but it hadn't been threaded yet." He said, "Well, ship the pipe now, you can ship the thread later."
Oh, no. Oh. How could you be so ignorant?
Well, I just mentioned that. Oh. You sometimes have to deal with things as basis of them. On another occasion, the Army officer asked me to give him the location of the country's major brass mines.
Oh, for heaven's sake. So there was some fundamental education to be done.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Also, I was used by a SARCO on many occasions to deal with people at the World Bank and at Ex-Im Bank and at the State Department with regard to problems we had in some of our overseas operations or in connection with financing. But the main burden of that was actually handled by people in the SARCO's legal office.
Did the CIA ever try to use your offices overseas?
They used to ask me questions.
Listening posts?
Yes, and they never asked me to go overseas, but they would talk to me about issues from time to time. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to explain to you what occupied my days at the SARCO, but perhaps we ought to go back to a question you asked me, which was the SARCO's involvement in uranium.
Yes.
When the AEC made its fateful decision to institute a program to offer a firm price, which I, as I recall it, may have been $8 to start with, but eventually became $10 a pound of U-308.
That's circular. I'm going by circular eight or something.
Whatever it was. It was clear that they were going to have to establish buying depots close to the areas where uranium was developed. And it was clear to me then that originally the AEC thought of this as a political gesture to satisfy the Western congressman that everything was being done to encourage domestic uranium production, but they did not expect much in the way of results.
This was about, what, 1940s?
Earlier.
Late 40s.
Late 40s.
Just after the war.
They knew that they were going to be producing a lot of atom bombs. They also believed that there was going to be development of atomic power, and that therefore substantial amounts of uranium would be needed, and there was big pressure from Congress. We can't allow ourselves to be dependent on imported uranium. We've got to do everything we can to develop domestic uranium. So this decision was made to offer a guaranteed price for a considerable period of time. 10 years is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
From my limited conversations on the subject with AEC personnel,
AEC was the Atomic Energy Commission, which was set up to handle this whole.
Yes. You may remember my namesake, Lewis Strauss, as he called himself, was the head of that for many years. I had the feeling from talking to AEC personnel, they didn't really expect much to happen. They were skeptical that there was going to be much uranium found, but as you remember, everybody and his uncle rushed out and bought Geiger counters and started heading for the hills, and the results far exceeded their expectations. But they did know that they had to be ready with buying stations scattered around the country. And they came to ASARCO, not to me, but to the people in the ore department at ASARCO, and said, you have to help us, because you have more expertise in how to go about buying ore than anybody else in the country, which was true.
Right.
We bought from very small miners. I mean, we'd have people who ship one carload of hand-picked gold ore a year to our East Helena smelter, and we made contracts with them. We understood how to deal with them, and what arrangements should be made in regard to payment, weighing, sampling, assaying, and so forth. They needed guidance on that, and they asked ASARCO to provide the guidance. In order to ensure that there would be no conflict of interest, they also said to ASARCO, we'll appreciate very much your guidance, for which we will not pay you anything, but you're not going to be permitted to go into the uranium exploration business yourself, because there would be a conflict. So ASARCO abstained from exploring for uranium.
And you weren't paid for your consultation?
No, the individuals, several people who either were ASARCO employees or who were retired ASARCO employees, I believe, went to work for them. One I remember in particular was a chap named Martin Gaines, G-A-I-N-E-S, who I think had been an ore buyer in Colorado, and he became an AEC employee.
You were closed out then. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we were closed out, and we didn't consider going into uranium until several years later, when the program was well established, and AEC indicated that there wouldn't be any objection if we wanted to, but the exploration department wasn't particularly eager to join the hunt. Other people had gotten so far ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And so.
So you never did any.
No, we did. We did not. Mm-hmm. The head of the raw materials division of AEC for years was a man named Jesse Johnson. Mm-hmm. Jesse C. Johnson. He and I had worked together in Metals Reserve, and we were good friends, and I used to see Jesse on occasion when I was in Washington, and he was good enough to invite me to attend the ceremony at Columbia University where he was presented with the Monell medal, you know, about that, M-O-N-E-L-L.
I remember the term, and that's
yeah.
all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was not given out very frequently, and when he was given the prize, he was the guest of honor at a very nice dinner in the Columbia Library, and my wife and I were invited to attend. Mm. But that was on a personal basis, because we had been such good friends. He was a great fellow, and he did a wonderful job. I've been trying to drum up some support for electing him to the National Mining Hall of Fame, but I don't think I'm getting very far. So that's the story on uranium.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the 70s, I would say that decade was split in two. There were the first 4 years, which were years of great expansion in business, mm-hmm. more perhaps in Japan than anywhere else in the world. Those were the days when the Japanese were really beginning to feel their oats and spreading their wings, building automobiles, building copper smelters and refineries, developing their transistor business, developing their computer business and
shipping.
And they were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they dragged up the rest of the world economy with them, because they were experiencing a 10% growth annually in gross national product, which is fantastic. And the United States was doing very well. And then in late 1973, early 74, the oil crisis developed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rest of the decade was really almost totally devoted to dealing with the question of the energy crisis, how are we going to cope with it, and of course in the background, the issue that you mentioned, the environment,
mm-hmm.
was heating up
mm-hmm.
month by month, year by year. So the metal markets were very strong. In the early part of that period, you may recall that President Nixon in 1971 had cut off the tie between gold and the dollar at $35 an ounce. He had seen the steady diminution in the gold reserves of the United States. He was fearful that the dollar was being adversely affected in international trade by our continuing to tie ourselves so tightly to gold. And he made that change. And then he followed it almost immediately by a price freeze. Do you recall that?
I'd forgotten the price freeze. Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the price freeze.
Yes, that was 72.
Well, actually, late 71.
Okay, I guess I've got it here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that price freeze revived the whole issue of the two price system in copper, for example, because the copper market took off like a rocket in the middle of 73. Under the Nixon formula, the domestic producers were held to the highest price in 1970, which had been 60 cents a pound. By the end of 1973, the London Metal Exchange was $1 a pound.
Mm.
And the distortions were just enormous. Obviously, foreign copper was selling at the LME price, whether brought to the United States or anywhere else. The consumers were screaming for cheap copper. Obviously, they took all the copper they could get at 60 cents a pound. There was no problem in selling the commodity. But the scrap dealers began to export in droves. For a while, the government talked about imposing embargoes on scrap, and the scrap dealers say, you can't do that to us. We can't get the scrap unless we can pay the world price for it. And finally, scrap was exempted from the price freeze so that scrap could be sold to consumers at world prices, and foreign copper could be sold to consumers in the United States at world prices. The only people who couldn't sell copper at world prices were the domestic producers. The situation wasn't as aggravated in lead and zinc, but in copper, it was horrific.
Now, had the nationalization in Chile
had taken effect? Part of the reason that the LME was as strong was that under the Allende administration, the production of copper by the government-owned operations had gone straight down. Allende had adopted the communist system. There was a political representative assigned to every production unit of everything, but particularly for the copper industry. And the decisions were made by him and not by the marketing people or the engineers. Chilean engineers by the droves left the country. The quality of Chilean copper deteriorated. I said that copper is fungible, but there were some customers in Europe who told me that under no condition would they take Chilean copper because the wire bars looked like a horseshoe instead of being nice straight bars. They drooped at both ends, the casting was so poor. So naturally this caused a scramble for good copper, Chilean production being as important as it is in the market. And
of course costs went up.
I beg your pardon?
Costs went up astronomically at the same time.
Right. So this was a very difficult period, but a prosperous period for the industry because the production was being sold. One of our customers had installed a facility for the production of continuous cast rod, which is
That was a big new development.
That's right. That was beginning to replace the wire bar, as they said. He had installed it in Utah, close to Kennecott. Found to this consumer.
Do you want to name the consumer?
No.
No. Okay.
He had put into effect a process no longer actively used for producing continuous rod called the dip forming process. It had been developed by General
DIP.
DIP. It had been developed by General Electric. You fed a copper wire into a bath of molten copper, and the copper adhered to it as it traveled through that path, and that created the rod. Obviously, there was some oxygen inclusions which had to be taken off, and it was also necessary to ensure a diameter, uniform diameter. Mm-hmm. So a certain amount of scrap was inevitable. However, this chap was not interested in Ron. He was interested in scrap. He was buying copper for 60 cents by taking it off as much of the rod as possible as scrap. Of course, he had to produce some rod, otherwise Kennecott would stop supplying him. But the more material he took off due to alleged imperfections as scrap, the more copper he could sell for $1 a pound without ever bothering to produce wine. Mm. You see, his scrap wasn't controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, this is an illustration of how
mm.
attempt to regulate markets result in all kinds of peculiar things, because people are ingenious and they figure out ways how to get around regulations.
Mm-hmm.
It was comparable in a way with the agricultural wheels that I told
mm-hmm.
you about from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So the effort continued to impose these price ceilings. As I remember it, the government at this point was authorized to sell copper from the stockpile.
Hmm.
And the Federal Emergency Management Agency, yeah, that's it. Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA.
They're the ones who come in after floods.
And earthquakes.
Earthquakes.
Yeah, but they also had the stockpile under their control at
oh.
the time.
Oh, okay.
And the FEMA officials were authorized to sell 120,000 tons, something like that, of copper that they had in the stockpile. This was in late 1973 and early 1974 when Mr. Nixon's price controls were still in effect. However, FEMA said they were not a domestic producer, therefore they were not subject to the controls. They put the stuff off for auction. And here's the government on the one hand telling producers they cannot sell copper for more than 60 cents a pound, and selling the copper at, I think the peak price it got was something like $1.15.
From the stockpile.
Stockpile copper sold to consumers at $1.15 a pound. I accumulated all the facts there, and Senator Goldwater made a little speech about that on the floor
mm-hmm.
of the Senate. But that was outrageous for the United States government, on the one hand, to say that to combat inflation, we have to control the prices,
mm-hmm.
and on the other hand, to auction off its own product and get a price almost double what the producers were allowed to get.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it was in December of 73 or maybe early in 74. I forget the name of the professor, was it Sawhill? Yes, John Sawhill, who was in charge of this price control effort for Nixon, agreed with great reluctance that the domestic copper producers could raise their price from 60 cents a pound to 68 cents a pound.
Mm.
So we moved up that far. But no further.
Hmm.
Finally, I think either at the end of March, you know, the price controls lapsed the authority to continue. And they were so unpopular by then that there wasn't any possibility. possibility of getting Congress to extend it. And the domestic industry was in a position to raise the price. The price was raised. There were labor negotiations underway. And it was a big problem. If we raised the price, the union was going to want more and more share of it. Mm-hmm. If we don't raise the price, we're not taking advantage of what we've been asking for all along. So the prices were raised. I think perhaps the price increase came on May 1st or June 1st for domestic producers. By July, the London Metal Exchange, because the energy crisis was beginning to take hold, suddenly started to hit bottom. And by September or October, the U.S. price, which had been so much lower than the world price, was now above the world price. It was the most absurd situation that the domestic copper industry was in. Uh-huh. And by the end of the year, the London price, if I recall correctly, at the beginning of 1973, the price of copper in London had been something like 50 cents a pound. By the end of 1973, it was well over a dollar a pound. It got up to maybe $1.20 a pound. And by December 31st, 1974, when it was clear that the full-scale recession was setting in, it was back down to 57 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just like the King of France marching his troops up the hill and then marching them down again. Mm-hmm. It was the most dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
In all the years that I've been in the copper business, I've seen a lot of fluctuations, but that 2-year period was just almost unparalleled.
Mm-hmm.
The other metals also changed a lot, but not anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the interesting consequences of the energy crisis was that it wasn't just the price of oil went up. In time, the price of coal went up. The charges for hydroelectric power, which theoretically shouldn't have had to change at all, began to move up. The aluminum companies, whose principal cost was power, 7 or 8 pounds per pound of metal, suddenly found themselves forced to increase prices in the face of a recession.
That affects the copper market.
That affected and helped the copper market.
Sure.
Because the big advantage, price advantage, that aluminum had had over copper began to disappear. And even more drastic effect came from the fact that the London Metal Exchange, which had never traded in aluminum, started trading in aluminum. You'll find the year in my book. I specify the date when it started. And suddenly, aluminum began to look more and more like copper. In the past, copper consumers had always said, why can't you be more like aluminum? But as a result of the energy crisis, the rise in costs, the increasing number of aluminum producers, the final, many of whom were government organizations in the Middle East and in Latin America, and finally the decision to trade aluminum on the LME, it wasn't why can't copper be more like aluminum? Is why is aluminum becoming so much like copper? Mm-hmm. And that has been the case ever since 1974. The growth in aluminum consumption since 1974 is roughly the same as the growth in copper consumption. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the period from 1950 to 1974, consumption of aluminum on a world basis had risen more than 8% a year compounded, as against 4% a year compounded for copper. Mm-hmm. Copper began to recover some of the uses that it had lost through substitution to aluminum. Mm-hmm. And my argument with customers always was, use the best metal. Forget about the price, because from now on, you're not going to find the aluminum price any more predictable than the copper.
Copper is a better conductor, isn't it?
It's a better conductor of electricity and a better conductor of heat. Mm-hmm. Aluminum has advantages. It's lighter. It's far more abundant. There's little likelihood that we'll ever have a shortage of aluminum. Someday, perhaps, we'll have a shortage of copper, although with the success geologists have had in recent years in finding new copper deposits, that day is pretty far off in mm-hmm. my judgment. So it's been a fascinating reversal of roles. And as I've commented in my book repeatedly, not only aluminum, but nickel and molybdenum, the two other metals which, like aluminum, were dominated by a major producer, Climax in the case of moly, Inco in the case of nickel, where research had resulted in a big growth in consumption patterns, where prices had been kept quite stable, they're now in the same category. There no longer is price stability. They no longer have what the economists call oligopoly-dominated markets. They have competitive markets, mm-hmm. as we do. So it's been a fascinating change, really. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How are we doing on time?
Well, it's 10 mm-hmm. after 4.
So we can go on for another mm-hmm. half hour. So.
The environmental movement and then the big strike and would be a couple of things we might try to get to.
Yes. Well, the big strike,
wasn't there one in late 70 also?
Well, not no. nearly of the same extent.
That wasn't, no. Okay.
No, there was the strike at Phelps Dodge, but that wasn't industry-wide. Mm-hmm. And that was the strike. I think you were thinking about where the troops were called out. Yes, I'll talk
about that. But that was just Phelps Dodge.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Another subject is going to be Bunker Hunt.
Mm.
And
well,
the
that
gold,
was in
gold
the
and silver mm-hmm. Situation. And, yeah, and then we'll talk about magma and,
right.
and my post. No, and my post.
Okay.
Post a Sarko career, but that can all come after we have dealt with these issues while I was still at a Sarko. I think we ought to say a little about gold now, because okay. we've talked about silver in some length. When Mr. Nixon cut the tie between the dollar and gold at $35 an ounce, there were people who said, gold is not an industrial material. If gold is not going to be tied to money any longer, the price of gold is going to drop. The New York Times said this in an editorial. They really believed that people would not be willing to pay as much as $35 an ounce any longer for a commodity that was not in demand from industry to any major extent. There are some industrial uses of gold, but the big use is jewelry, which is, can hardly be described as an industrial use. And most of the jewelry use, or much of the jewelry use, is tied in with people's perception of gold as a store of value. If it was truly felt that the U.S. decision to stop buying gold at $35 an ounce meant that gold was no longer to have a monetary role, would people feel, well, there's no use holding on to gold? It isn't tied in with money. Of course, the reverse of that happened. And right from the start, the price of gold started to rise. For a while, the rise was very modest. But then, when Congress, recognizing the inevitable, repealed the restrictions on the ownership of gold by individuals, restrictions that had applied since 1935 or 34, when the $35 an ounce price came in. When that was repealed, a lot of American citizens began to think, well, it wouldn't be bad to have some gold. And more than that, people in other countries began to think that. And we saw gold coins being offered to the public. The holding of gold coins became eligible, became legal.
Mm-hmm.
I had had an interesting experience returning from a trip to Japan shortly after the Olympics were held in Tokyo. I had been given by the Japanese manufacturer of the Olympic medals a little plastic box containing a gold, a silver, and a bronze medal, as if I had won the hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
It was very nice of him to do it. He gave it to me because Asarco had been his principal source of silver for the manufacture of these medals. And on my return from Tokyo, this was in the middle 60s, I happened to call on one of the officials of the Treasury, Leland Howard, to discuss the silver coinage issue with him. And I mentioned that I'd been in Japan. And I mentioned that I had brought this back. He said, that's illegal. He said, you can't have that medal unless you won something. Well, I said, didn't you read that I'd won? But that was a fact. Mm-hmm. I had apparently innocently contravened the law by bringing, he didn't inform anybody about it. Nobody's ever taken my medal away from me.
Uh-huh.
But that was a fact.
Mm-hmm.
We had at Asarco, we could only sell gold to people who had licenses from the Treasury to hold gold. They had to account to the Treasury for how much gold they had on hand, what they used it for, and so forth. It was very strictly controlled. While Congress recognized that this was ridiculous to keep this on, after we said, in essence, that gold has nothing to do with our money,
mm-hmm.
So that bill was repealed, and people were in a position to start owning gold coins, gold medals, or whatever form of gold they chose to have. And the demand increased in spite of the severe recession throughout the world, because there is this mystical link between people and gold that No amount of legislation can gainsay.
You can't convince a billion Chinese not to want gold.
No, no. I mean, it's in our culture. It's certainly in their culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's been in every civilization that you can mention that gold has been prized and valued. Mm-hmm. So the price gradually started to rise, but it didn't really take off in a big way until the end of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
When Nelson Bunker Hunt began to speculate in silver, and it sort of rubbed off on gold. The rise in the price of silver was much sharper than in the price of gold. And it had weird effects.
It must have been a real shock to you.
Well, I had expected silver to go to $5, $6 an ounce. Mm-hmm. That it would go to $50 an ounce, I had not realized.
No.
I think I told you earlier that I had accumulated silver coins, expecting that eventually they would be worth more than the face value. So I had a lot of dimes and quarters and half dollars, which I put away in a drawer. I never went into a bank and changed money for coins, simply as they came into my hands through ordinary transactions. But when the Hunt operation started and the price began to escalate, it was around September or October of 79, and by the end of the year it was up around $20 an ounce, and then January was absolutely fantastic. I made a decision that I would sell $10 face value of coins each week to a coin dealer, just to see what was going on in the coin shops. It was a way for me to go in there and not just stand around and perhaps be suspected to be about to hold the place up or something. So once a week I would walk in either with 100 dimes or 40 quarters or 20 half dollars and exchange them for money. The best exchange I made was in January of 1980, when I took 40 quarters of no numismatic value and got a check for $300.
Mm.
My $10 worth of coins gave me $300. There was about 7 ounces of silver in that.
Mm.
And that week, the local men's clothing store in New Rochelle had its annual January clearance sale. I was about to leave to spend the month of February and most of March in Tucson lecturing at the university. And I decided I needed a suit to travel in. They had a brown tweed suit that I liked very much that had been knocked down in price. I bought it for $299. When the Rotary Club in Tucson asked me to talk about gold and silver at their weekly luncheon meeting, I wore the suit. I said, there's no way I can explain to you what's going on in gold and silver better than by telling you that I'm wearing a $10 suit. And I explained that I exchanged my $10 for $300 in cash and then used $299 of it to buy that suit.
Pretty dramatic illustration, isn't it?
There was a drugstore in the building where I had had my office when I was in Washington that I passed by on one of my visits to the American Mining Congress on the corner of Vermont Avenue and 15th Street, had in the window, it they serve breakfast, you know, they had a fountain.
Mm-hmm.
They serve breakfast. It said, orange juice, 2 eggs any style, toast, coffee, 10 cents. And underneath in small letters it said, in silver coin.
They knew.
They knew.
Hmm.
So, that was the effect of the hunts. What the hunts didn't realize, and what I could observe as I sold my coins each week, was pushing the price up had the classic effect, it always does, it encouraged supply and it reduced demand. It encouraged supply. I particularly remember one little mousy sort of Irish woman that was standing in front of me who went to the counter. She had 3 or 4 silver spoons in her hand. She said, will you buy these? He said, of course. He looked and saw the sterling mark. He weighed them. He paid her for it. She was probably somebody's cook and stolen 3 pieces of sterling ware.
Mm-hmm.
And what she was doing on a small scale was being done on a major scale throughout the country by professional thieves.
Mm-hmm. You heard stories of people going out with and melting silver.
Yeah, they ran around in vans and had pizza ovens in them, but they melted down the sterling silverware as they stole it because they didn't want the marks on it to be around. And of course, the insurance rates on sterling silverware skyrocketed, and people began to say to themselves, why do I keep this stuff around here? It costs too much. The insurance is too high. They either put it in their safe deposit boxes or they sold it to be melted.
And the brides turned to stainless steel.
Exactly. The, as I think I say in my book, the consumption of silver for sterling where in the United States the year before this, in other words, 78 or 79, but something like 27 million ounces. It's currently about 5 million ounces. That's a market that was actually killed by what the speculation in silver did. So consumption was cut drastically. The only ones who didn't cut were the Eastman Kodak people, and they tried to economize as much as they could. They raised their prices for their film, so they got the money back. And when the price of silver subsequently dropped, I don't think their prices dropped quite as much as as the price of silver. But supply rose dramatically from secondary sources. Consumption was cut, and the stage was set for the subsequent problems that we've had with silver, which have been compounded in the last few years, because so many of the new gold mines have very substantial silver byproducts. There's a mine that Echo Bay has in Nevada called the McCoy Cove mine. Is producing 10 million ounces of silver a year, I believe. And Placer Dome has a mine in Chile called Coipa, C-O-I-P-A, which is turning out 12 to 15 million ounces. It's primarily a coal mine, but they have all the silver along with it. So silver production has risen sharply as a result of the increase in gold production. Offsetting whatever loss there's been in silver production from that over. And consumption was badly affected. It's beginning to come back now. And I think the prices of silver are quite likely to show fairly good strength over the next few years. Not, I hope, ever to go back to $40 or $50 an ounce.
Or gold to
$800. Well, gold is more likely to recover to 800 than silver to 40 or 50.
Wow.
Okay.
Is that a good
Yeah, I think
okay.
so.